Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vaga Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dunbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who's now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association, both of whom have played key presidential defense transition roles over the past four decades. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Privileged to be here, Vago.
Great to be back, Vago.
Indeed, it's great to have both of you back on. And before we start, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Arnold, Dr. Kath Hicks testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. What did we learn from her testimony? And more importantly, or as importantly, what's her timeline, given that Lloyd Austin is now somewhat home alone, aside from a whole bunch of other folks who are doing placeholder roles?
Well, Vago, a very timely topic, and is someone that has been involved in and looked at confirmation hearings of Deputy Secretary of Defense going back to the 1970s, and thinking about some of the standouts like Graham Clater in the Carter administration and Frank Carlucci, Bill Perry in the Clinton administration. Dr. Hicks, Kath Hicks, did a truly superb job during her confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. She was most impressive, demonstrated her knowledge of all matters national security, showed her experience, was very responsive to the senator's questions, but at the same time, preserved a lot of options for the Biden administration in areas where we know, and they've announced ongoing reviews, such as the budget, the nuclear modernization programs, a global posture review, sexual harassment, and many others. So I would say a terrific job, strong bipartisan support. Her nomination has now been reported to the Senate executive calendar, out from the Senate Armed Services Committee, giving the Senate the option of confirming her before the impeachment trial and their recess starts, so we don't lose another couple of weeks. So keeping our fingers crossed, the Senate is in a position to get her over there as the number two in the Pentagon, and also as the number two confirmed person in the Pentagon here in a matter of days. And you're right, Lloyd Austin is the only one there now, and frankly, the only other nomination that they have pending in the Senate Armed Services Committee is for the Undersecretary for Policy.
Right.
And it's not clear to me that one is going to move anytime soon for a number of reasons. And by the way, they've got to get on top of the budget. One of the points that Dr. Hicks made during her confirmation hearing was the lack of access to the budget, traditional lack of access to the budget material, has put them way behind the timeline that where they need to be there. But all in all, anybody that saw that hearing has to be both inspired and reassured that we're going to have a Deputy Secretary of Defense that is fully up to the very, very difficult job that she faces when she gets over there early next week. Over.
And Kath is one of the foremost thinkers in town on this, and somebody experienced across the board. So we certainly do wish her well. Michael, talk to us about what some of her big challenges on the job are going to be. Obviously, there are the reviews that are ongoing, but then there's a budget that looms. That's got to be out in April. The Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, also announced among the slate of reviews, from force posture to everything else, a 60-day stand down to tackle extremism. From your standpoint, what are going to be the biggest challenges Kath faces in the job?
Well, first, Vago, I have to loudly agree with Arnold. Hicks is a uniquely qualified candidate, and she gave an absolutely terrific performance. She was confident. She more than answered the questions, and I found from time to time she even lightly instructed the United States senators on the dais. So the bottom line to my jaded ear, she was better and stronger than even some of the more recently nominated secretaries of defense. But as Arnold and I have said, and you've agreed, Vago, this is the second toughest job in the executive branch, bar none. You have to take the top level strategic guidance, which comes from everywhere, guidance from the secretary. You got to figure out how to turn that into practical implementation. And frankly, for her and for Lloyd Austin, the challenge is the strategic direction the past several years has often been quite wrong. So that says she has a huge warrant at an unprecedentedly challenging time. She has to not only manage the defense budget, she's going to have to change the department and change it a lot, which is an incredibly large challenge. So if Austin is the outside guy and Hicks as the inside person, the big challenge the challenges Austin will be facing that everyone talks about, the Middle East, cyber, China, those are his problems. She's got to steer the department towards new technologies at a time in which we've often said budgets are expected to be at best flat. The department also is going to have to expand its activities in a lot of areas they have not done previously, COVID-19, climate change, rebalancing the economies, and so on. Those things are going to put really new and unusual responsibilities. And all of this has to happen with a rebalance between the DoD civilian policy shop and leadership and the uniform and joint staff. By law, as the commission pointed out, policy is supposed to be driven by the civilian staff with inputs from the joint staff. But over time, that shifted, particularly under Secretary Mattis, and the uniformed officials have had more and more say in this. So I would say, when you look at all she's done, her background, her writing, what she's been involved with, she crucially understands the capabilities and the budget processes. And I think we're in for quite a ride with her. Over.
And Vago, I think I want to add very quickly, sure, not only the rebalance between civil and military in the building, she's going to have to help rebalance the relationship. As Biden has said very clearly and demonstrated in his speech at the State Department, diplomacy will lead and defense will support. That's a role they're not used to. And the other point I would make is President Biden is making good on just about everything he said he was going to do in the national security area. So anybody in the building that thinks they're going to basically, you know, hold their breath and not be able to make the fundamental adjustments that he's talked about, Dr. Hicks is going to be in a position to help drive those priorities throughout the department. Over.
Where do we stand on the other presidential appointees, Arnold? I mean, you mentioned, for example, that we're waiting on confirmation, and it's going to take a little bit longer for the Undersecretary for Policy. Tom Harker has asked Hondo Gertz, the Navy's former acquisition executive, to and Tom Harker, of course, acting Secretary of the Navy, asked Hondo to come and serve as the number two in the Navy in this interim period. So obviously there are repercussions for not having butts in seats. At the end of the day, you know, it's been 3 weeks since we've seen the last, almost 3 weeks since we've seen the last announcements. When should we expect to see more announcements come in for all these key jobs? Because all of Washington is wondering who's the Army Secretary, who's the Navy Secretary, who's at Air Force Acquisition and Sustainment Research and Development, and so on.
Well, Vago, I have one along with Michael that have argued to every administration at the outset, they need to accelerate their vetting and nomination process so the Senate can get cranked up. Right now, the Senate only has one pending nomination of the 61 that were PASs for the Department of Defense. That is presidentially appointed, Senate confirmed. You have Lloyd Austin that's confirmed, CAF that will soon be confirmed. So that's two of 61. You have one pending, but they don't have any other nominations. And if you look at the processing times in previous administrations, the first service secretary didn't show up in the Trump administration until late May, right before Memorial Day. The Navy Secretary, Richard Spencer, didn't come till August. And so we've got to accelerate these times. And right now, they're not on an accelerated timetable for the nominations. And the processing time, once we get nominations in the Senate, they were averaging, you know, 60 days in the committee and about 40 days on the executive calendar in the Senate. Frankly, there were some nominations that were, you know, almost a year in the process once they got in the Senate. So we've got to, first of all, the Senate will say very clearly that there are some nominations we don't confirm once we have them, but we darn sure don't confirm any that we don't have. So the burden right now is on the Biden administration, you know, to make their picks, make sure they're vetted, get them to the Senate, and work very carefully with the Senate Armed Services Committee to get them confirmed on a much faster basis than we've seen in recent years. I would say, though, that, of course, all of the 61 PASs either have a confirmed person, Lord Austin, Kath Hicks, soon to be confirmed as the deputy, but they have either acting or performing the duties of either career civilians or people that came in on January 20th in those jobs. So technically, they're not vacant. They're people in all those positions. Right. Over.
Yeah, and Vago, this stands in stark contrast to what's going on at the White House and the NSC and at the State Department, where we're seeing the build out much more rapidly and tightly focused. So it's the most often said thing in Washington, people or policy. It'll be essential for Kath Hicks and Lloyd Austin to have their subordinate teams in place rapidly. They cannot do it all by themselves. Over.
And we saw from the president the focus, right, that we've discussed on this program many times, that foreign policy is what is going to dictate national security. And we're seeing that president obviously going to the State Department to make his first foreign policy address, setting the tone and also the horsepower that's on the National Security Council. We're running out of time, but very quickly, Michael, start us off. You both have served on numerous boards. Michael, you were the Defense Business Board Chairman, but have served on numerous government advisory boards. Same with you, Arnold, Reserve Policy Board were among the panels you guys served on. The Trump administration, as was its purview, sacked both of you from all, and indeed almost everybody from all of its boards to install its own people on it. Now, Secretary Austin is calling for a review to try to get as much value as possible from these boards. Really quickly, from both of you, what should he bear in mind as he does this? Because to me, oftentimes these boards recommend solutions that the Pentagon leadership or lawmakers are skittish about. And the other thing is, I've looked at this as a legal way for senior defense officials to tap the talent base that exists outside in sort of a legal way, right? I mean, essentially, you guys are all available to advise leaders. What does he have to bear in mind as he goes through this review process?
Well, thanks, Vago. Yeah, I, like Arnold, I've probably chaired half a dozen of these things over the decades, and so I do have a little bit of insight about this. First, two myths. These boards, membership on boards, are not rewards. They are hard work with lots of hours required and no pay. And second myth, they don't need fresh people who don't know the department. It takes years for an outsider to know enough about DOD to matter. That if boards like these, that is science, business, policy, have to have people on them who the secretary and the deputy see as peers, and they know the ground those leaders have to take and hold. So it's the boards are where the senior leaders go for this outside advice, for real in-depth context. It's the what of the Secretary of Defense's job, but they also provide the how to solve problems or do things. The value of them is at the moment. And this is a really unusual moment because America is in a peer on near peer struggle, with the near peer increasingly destined to be us, not them. So while that's going on, the global business and financial communities are well ahead of the Department of Defense. And the Department of Science and Engineering simply can't succeed without the best outside ideas, technology, and people. And many of the global challenges Lloyd Austin will face are better understood by our opponents, our allies, and those former people who have served in his positions at State, Treasury, or Defense. So where does Austin and Hicks gather these insights? It's a properly configured business, science, and policy board. It's really important to return these boards to their original animating principle. That is, people who are serving on them solely for the nation, the very best of the country, doing the best work for the nation.
Arnold?
Marco, the expertise required for our Department of Defense to deal with peer-on-peer, the cutting-edge technologies, the private sector and our adversaries moving much quickly than our bureaucracies moved. Outside independent objective expertise is needed more than ever. The Federal Advisory Committee Act allows for that to happen in a very legal process way. The department needs this outside expertise now more than ever. Hopefully this review, they will come to that conclusion. We also know over time, the Pentagon is not always right. They need people helping them.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. It's always an honor and pleasure having you on. Looking forward to having you guys back on next week. Have a great weekend in the meantime.
Thank you, Vago.
It's always a pleasure, Vago.
And joining us now for a roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center, and a professor emeritus at American University. He was formerly the White House's top national security official during the Clinton administration. Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Hurston of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many affiliations is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back to the program. Michael, start us off. President Biden is pushing a $1.9 trillion COVID stimulus package. It went through Voterama up on the Hill. The president went to the State Department and gave a major speech saying America was back on the world's stage. At the Pentagon, Lloyd Austin has launched a series of reviews from global posture to a 60-day stand down of the U.S. military to confront extremism in the ranks. Start us off, right, because there are new SASC, Senate Armed Services Committee composition, an update on the Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, as well as the chi up there, right? I mean, on the one hand, Republicans are saying, hey, Biden was talking about unity and bipartisanship, but he's sort of leaving us in the cold on stimulus. On the other hand, the administration is saying, hey, we got elected to deliver stimulus, which is exactly what we're going to do. Talk to us about where we are and what all this means, especially for defense.
Sure. So a lot of things happening on the Hill this week. So as you just correctly pointed out, the Senate Armed Services Committee has reorganized, and there are three new members. Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama is now on the committee, along with Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona and Senator Jackie Rosen from Nevada. The House Armed Services Committee officially reorganized this week. With the narrowed majority, the ratio now is 31 Democrats and 28 Republicans. And as we mentioned on a previous podcast, they were creating a new subcommittee by breaking up the Intelligence and Emerging Threat Subcommittee into two subcommittees. The primary subcommittee with a larger jurisdiction was going to be initially called the Subcommittee on Future Defense Technologies. However, now the new name is the Subcommittee on Cyber Innovation Technologies and Information Systems, which they're calling CITI for short. And Congressman Langevin, who chaired the IET subcommittee, will chair that subcommittee. The new subcommittee, which is called the Subcommittee on Intelligence and Special Operations, will be chaired by Ruben Gallego of Arizona. So he now emerges into a subcommittee chairmanship. And that subcommittee will oversee military intelligence, national intelligence, special operations, countering chem-bio threats, counterproliferation, and counterterrorism. So, as you mentioned, too, a lot of activity on the Hill this week with the budget resolutions. The House passed their budget resolution on Wednesday, pretty much along a party line vote. Last night, as you mentioned, the Senate had their Voterama. Things worked differently in the Senate. There were 400 amendments, so they did not end up passing the resolution until 5:35 a.m. This morning.
And you know that's 5:35 a.m. because you were awake for every single minute of it.
Not this one.
Okay.
So, yeah, but as you mentioned, I mean, this is the vehicle they're going to use for reconciliation to get COVID relief done. But, you know, Senator Romney has told reporters that not a single Republican is going to support the president's COVID relief package as it stands unless modifications are made. And as you've seen reported, 10 Republican senators have proposed their own alternative package and were invited over to the White House to discuss it with President Biden. And 10 is the magic number, right? If you get 10 Republican senators to go along with the 50 Senate Democrats, you don't have to use the reconciliation process because you'll be able to get to cloture. But right. I think, you know, the clock is running. The Biden folks really want to get moving on this package. They feel it's really important for their ability to end the pandemic and kickstart the economy, and also to fund vaccine distribution, which is going slower than people anticipated. But the Biden administration has indicated things they're willing to be flexible on. While they are holding firm on $1,400 checks to individuals, they are flexible on who gets those checks, just not on the amount of those checks. They are, however, looking like they're going to have to bend on the minimum wage increase that's included in his package. An amendment passed last night among the 400 that were offered that would prohibit a minimum wage increase during the pandemic. And besides that, he can't get all 50 Democratic senators to support a minimum wage increase. And there's some sign that he's willing to be flexible on the size of the package from $1.9 trillion, maybe down to as low as $1.3, especially since they're going to have two bites of the apple when it comes to budget reconciliation, because they can pass one for FY21, another for FY22, right, whereas the second one will be focused more on hopefully COVID recovery versus COVID relief. Then we had a lot of drama this week centered around Liz Cheney and Marjorie Greene with the votes in the Republican conference. As everybody knows, Liz Cheney survived a challenge to her leadership position on Wednesday night by a vote of 145 to 61. It was a resounding victory, but it was a secret ballot. And I think a lot of us think that if it was not a secret ballot, the vote would have been a lot closer for her, because I think a lot of folks would have had to show publicly to their base for fear of a primary that they were opposing somebody who was so much out front opposing the president and supporting impeachment. Then there's been a lot of drama this week around whether to remove Congresswoman Marjorie Greene from her committees because of all of the statements she's made over the years, including her time in Congress, that, you know, discounting 9/11, questioning whether the Parkland school shootings were real, a lot of anti-Semitic statements accusing the Jews of starting the wildfires in California and killing Kennedy. So
Jewish space lasers.
Exactly. So, you know, the Republicans really were trying to draw a distinction between the things she was saying before she was in Congress versus the things she said since she's been in Congress. Apparently, in the private conference meeting among the House Republicans, she apologized privately, but has not apologized publicly. And in fact, she's been able to use this situation to raise $1.6 million since people have been calling for her expulsion. And it's an incredible amount of money in a very short period of time. And it's interesting that 11 of her Republican colleagues voted to expel her from committees when that vote was on the floor last night, more than voted to impeach the president. There was a lot of feeling among Democrats. I talked to a lot of Pelosi lieutenants leading up to this vote, that this vote was actually a mistake on the Democrats' part last night, because you're doing Kevin McCarthy's job for him. Kevin, should have been the one to remove her from committees. He tried to split the baby by offering up to the Democrats, let's take her off of Ed and Labor, but leave her on budget. Democrats rejected that. And you could have kept it as the Republicans' problem and said the Democrats took that issue away from them by removing her. And there's a threat going forward of tit for tat. You know, the Democrats only have a 5-seat majority in the House. It's a lifetime between the next election. If the Republicans were to take control back of the House in 2 years, do they try and remove Ilhan Omar from her committees? Do they try and remove AOC of those committees? It's a really, I think, dangerous precedent to set.
Right. But in fairness, right, I mean, neither one of them are saying the kind of caliber of out there stuff that Marjorie Greene is saying. And, you know, neither one of them posed with a weapon with, you know, saying I'm going to blow Nancy Pelosi's head off and stuff like that. Right. I mean, this is a little bit more extreme than we've seen from other members of Congress in a while. I think we can agree.
Yes, absolutely, without question. But Pelosi's calculus here was strictly political. She wanted to put those Republicans on the record supporting Marjorie Greene so they should use it against them in the campaigns.
Mackenzie, from your standpoint, right, you're a creature of the Hill, specifically of the Senate, once upon a time. What does this do for bipartisanship? What does this do for the ability to legislate going forward, right? I mean, at the end of the day, on the one hand, the president is talking about unity and bipartisanship. On the other hand, you know, I think it's safe to say that the Republicans didn't even close to meeting him sort of halfway, right? I mean, it was $620 billion or whatever it was, which you can argue is quite a big of a delta between that and $1.9 trillion. How do you see this affecting the debate and the relationship going forward?
I think that there's poison in the well already. You know, the belief among a lot of Republicans is unity schmunity. They never meant it. It was just a bunch of, you know, waxing poetic on inauguration day to get voters to swoon in the media, and everybody did. But there was no question that this COVID stimulus was going to get rammed through at an astronomical price tag. We're dropping trillions now like they're $20 bills. It's really shocking, and to me as a voter and a taxpayer, and astonishing. I understand we're in an emergency, but remember, this is coming on top of over $4 trillion that's been authorized by Congress to be spent. Not all of that, of course, has been spent. So this is the 2022 midterms are well underway, which is disturbing, right? I mean, there's so much work to get done and they really do need to find ways to work together. I'm deeply distressed about it because I think there is a lot of room for bipartisanship, but the attitude is that we're not off to a good start.
And I have to say that in terms of the members I've talked to and the folks up on the Hill, I think it's a mutual distrust, right? I mean, the Democrats don't trust the Republicans and the Republicans are saying, you know, well, you guys aren't turning a page as quickly as possible. And I think David Brooks had a good piece in the New York Times on that this morning. Byron, we also had Kath Hicks testify as Deputy Defense Secretary. You wrote a very thoughtful note on how you're interpreting all of this, including her testimony. Give us a sense on how you read her performance. You know, we heard at the top of the show, Arnold and Michael liked it very, very much. There was a lot to like. What else did you take away from that, as well as what else is going on up there?
Well, look, I agree with that assessment. I thought Hicks did a great job during the hearing. She didn't step on any landmines. There weren't any major controversies. I thought she came away with a lot of support from the committee. You know, for me, what I listened to during these nomination hearings is not so much what the nominee says, but also what the members of the Senate are asking for, because I think that's a good way to kind of gauge what's on their mind, what are their concerns. And the one thing that stuck out for this hearing were the number of questions that were asked about strategic modernization, the triad, and specifically the ground-based strategic deterrent program. I don't think there was anything conclusive that came away from this, but that's going to be a talking point going forward, as we've talked about during this discussion in the prior episodes of the podcast. The other thing that I think was interesting was, you know, she kind of hedged her support a bit for the Battle Force 2045 plan. I think it was interesting. She said that there were some quote unquote flags in that assessment, that there was more analysis that needed to be done. So it was kind of a tempered support for the Navy's expansion program, which again, I wouldn't consider as a surprise in any way, shape or form, but I think it's just interesting that got aired out. And I personally would be surprised too, given the budget environment, if the Navy was able to realize that plan.
I should also point out, you know, to support, or at least the administration uses as support, right? Only 49,000 jobs were created last month, which is suggests for a somewhat tepid recovery or maybe continuing problem. Gordon, you are one of the people who has passionately and long argued that diplomacy has to be at the center of American foreign policy, and you use all the arms of power. You don't militarize American foreign policy, which is your concern. The president went to the State Department, stood next to the Secretary of State, and made his address about America being back and the importance of diplomacy. Reversing the troop cut the Trump administration did, was moving ahead with in order to punish Germany for not spending enough on defense, and also change course in terms of stopping U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's operations in Yemen. What did you think of his message? And as a tough professor, how did you grade him?
Well, I think he gets at least a B on his speech, if not maybe even an A-. I think it's very interesting. Of course, concerns about the militarization of U.S. global engagement are not just mine alone. Interestingly, Kath Hicks was introduced by Bob Gates, who spoke eloquently to this question and this problem when he was Secretary of Defense, as did Jim Mattis. And interestingly enough, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced yesterday, and the president mentioned it in his talk, a global force posture review. And what was interesting about the Global Force Posture Review announcement, which was only a page long, is that he refers three times to the importance of working with diplomacy and the supremacy of diplomacy and the military as a last use rather than a first use in American engagement. Three times in five or six paragraphs, kind of got the message. I thought it was a good speech. It was a solid speech the president gave. The only real news in it probably was Yemen and the Saudi support for the operations in Yemen, which is serious because it's logistics, it's targeting. It's not just, waving at them and wishing them luck. U.S. has been quite seriously and intimately engaged with the Saudi effort in Yemen. And I thought the announcement on blocking the withdrawal of troops from Germany was a solid statement towards the Allies. So on the whole, he gave the right speech in the right place, not flaming wild rhetoric, didn't rise soaringly, but it touched all of the bases. And it was a very good statement for him to have made. So, you know, it ties in with the firmness of it, ties in with the effort they are making in the Congress to put through this COVID relief package, as opposed to McKenzie's use of the term rammed through. The use of reconciliation is something that rammed through, if you will, the Republican tax cuts under George Bush, the Republican tax cuts under Ronald Reagan. It's a procedure that's quite common in the Congress, been used more than 20 times. And it doesn't surprise me at all, given the margin that the administration thinks this is timely and important, and that this is a legislative strategy they'd like to see the Congress use. So what all of that says to me, there's a kind of a really interesting, a sort of clarity of purpose, clarity of direction. You may agree with some, you may disagree with some, but it's kind of refreshing not to feel whipsawed every day when you turn around and find out that the White House has done something you didn't expect.
I would agree with both of your points, right? One person, whoever it is who didn't get their legislative way points to this and says it's been rammed through. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, using the political process to actually not do anything was not positive, including, and I'm not trying to pick sides on it, but Mitch McConnell saying, you know, I'm the graveyard keeper of by not bringing legislation forward is problematic, because at the end of the day, that's why they make the big money. One of the things you didn't mention is there's also an Afghanistan review that's being chaired by former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joe Dunford. Dove, give us your sense on the president's message and the Yemen and Saudi Arabia issue in particular, right? I mean, we've discussed that quite a bit on the program. And this comes at a time when the Chinese have dramatically been increasing their footprint in the region and their influence. And so now it's really kind of a great power game that once upon a time it was us and the Brits. Now it's us and the Chinese in the region more than anybody else. You know, sort of talk to us about, you know, how you read his comments. What do you think they mean? How do you think they'll be received, and the Saudi issue, Saudi Yemen issue in particular? And the arms export suspension as well.
Yeah, let me start with the general point. I agree that what Biden really was telling the world is it's going to be all of government, something that I've also argued for a long time. And particularly, there's a new study out from the Atlantic Council that I wrote about in today's Hill that talks about the need for all of government. In fact, the declassified paper about Asia, the Indo-Pacific, that they that the Trump administration declassified just before it left, which was probably written by Matt Pottinger, also talked about all of government, except they didn't really mean it, or they didn't execute on it. I think these guys are going to execute on it, and that's very important. You can't deal with China just in military terms, and frankly, you can't deal with just about anything just in military terms. So I think that in many ways, that's the most important outcome of what Biden said. He talked very tough on Russia, and he made it clear that he had made it clear to Putin that he had talked very tough on Russia. That is important as well. I think Moscow needs to understand that the days of being fawned on are over, and that, of course, ties into the aftermath of the Navalny trial and arrest, which the president also raised. On the questions of Saudis and Afghanistan, look, what Biden did was basically say, we're not going to help you fight in Yemen anymore. And at the same time, he said, we're not going to let you just be vulnerable to the Houthis. That's the part that people have not focused on. We're going to continue to provide the Saudis with the ability to defend themselves against the Houthis and presumably against the Iranians as well. And I think that's why, in part, the Saudis, who've been trying to figure out a way to get out of Yemen anyway, were much milder in response to Biden than one might have expected. They want to stay in his good books. They want to be sure that the commitments are there. There's a lot of talk about having facilities in Western Saudi Arabia. in order to be more flexible in the region. So we kind of need them as well. Biden handled that exceedingly well, I thought. And on Afghanistan, you know, the Dunford group is basically saying, don't pull out. We're only down to 2,500 troops. There's been reports verified from what I understand that the Iranians are talking to the Taliban again. And of course, you do worry about the Chinese in Afghanistan. So pulling out anything beyond what's already been done probably would be a serious mistake. And my guess is the Biden people will be listening to what Dunford and his commission, which was very high powered, are saying about all of this.
Mackenzie, I know you've got a punch in a moment. I wanted to get your sense on the reviews as well. And what do you know, are these preordained outcomes from your standpoint? I mean, unfortunately, one of the unfortunate things about reviews like this is it depends on the guidance that you get at the end of the day. And so these reviews tend to mirror what administrations want. And I want to also get your sense on the extremism review. You know, there are some who look at that and say, well, they didn't know what else to do, so they did a 60-day stand down. Others argue, and I believe Secretary Austin would say this is, look, the nation expects us to do something about this, and it's pretty serious, and let's get our arms wrapped around it. Because if you find an excess, you know, if the military is a pipeline to militias that are seeking to overthrow the government, that's kind of a bad news story and reflects poorly on the rest of the department. So give us your sense on all of that. And then Gordon, want to get your take as well.
Sure. And of course, then there are all the internal Defense Department reviews underway in addition to the ones that you've outlined. I don't think any are essentially preordained, but there is a common theme here among all of, the executive orders issued to date, the reconciliation to pass a party line vote, $2 trillion stimulus, and now the stand down. And of course, the theme is, you know, go the opposite direction of President Trump and run in the other way. So pretty much anything that the president, the last president liked, this team's going to hate. So that's not unusual, obviously. I think that's just a common theme among party switches in the White House. But it's to me, it's interesting how stark it is, how many issues it is, because in a lot of ways, in a lot of remarks that the last president gave, if you had inserted a Democratic name like Obama, he did sound like a Democrat on a lot of foreign policy, you know, position, you know, calling for restraint and, you know, things like that. So it's kind of interesting to me. On the stand down, you know, I read the press secretary's remarks and I just couldn't get, I agree with you, you know, they need to do something. They need to show it's serious. They need to start somewhere. Secretary Austin wants to be a leader on the issue, but it was really hard. There's such a lack of detail and guidance to commanders of what to do about it. And it's unclear if they're going to collect any data or how the information will then flow back up, which is gathered from the stand down. So, you know, I wish they would have taken just like one more week to think it through a little more thoughtfully, because it could be something that turns out to be very valuable. Anytime you get that kind of information from the entire force, kind of writ large, a snapshot in time, that's good stuff. But I'm not sure that this was really methodically planned in terms of what to do, what to say, how to, not necessarily programmatically what to say, but topics to cover, how long to do it, and then how do you share that information and how do you keep it, store it, and share it. Those steps weren't well thought out. Maybe a missed opportunity.
Gordon, I'm going to go to you in a minute. I mean, I do think it's interesting because there are, in some ways, Donald Trump did make Joe Biden's job easier in some respects, right? I mean, he already made it, set kind of a tough tone. Biden can now build on that and do it in a more joined up fashion on cyber and a whole bunch of other things. It seems like they're going to build on what the last administration did as opposed to repudiate everything, right? CMMC being a good example where there's bipartisan consensus. But I agree, there's a lot that is being unwound. Gordon, I know you have thoughts on this, and so do you, Dove. So Gordon, start us off, and then you, Dove.
Yeah, there are a lot of reviews going on. I'm not going to be too judgmental about where they come out yet because it's just way too early, but they're a very good set of reviews. I think the extremism review is a stand down is a very good one. dealing with the racial issues in the military is going to be very important. The steps that they have taken on sexual assault, on LGBTQ, all in the right direction. Again, there's a kind of consistency of direction here, even if it is very clearly a reversal of some of the themes from the Trump White House. You know, the Department of Defense was always a little better on this stuff than the White House was. And I don't envy Kathy Hicks her job, because she's going to have to be walking around watching all of these reviews going on at the same time. What I was struck by in the rather brief statement about the global posture or force posture review, it's been called both, was there's, you know, an awesome lack of detail there in terms of what it's going to cover. And it sounded very much, since it was looking, the words that were used were footprint, resources, strategy, missions on a global basis. Well, now we're kind of in QDR land, we're kind of in national defense strategy land, national military strategy land. It's not clear how these reviews may relate to each other, given the standard set of reviews that one expects them to undertake, global nuclear posture review, et cetera. You're always going to get a lot of reviews at the beginning of the administration, and I think they're particularly critical at this point in time, given the idea of having diplomacy take the lead. I'd like to have seen the State Department more centrally focused on in the statements about the global posture review, because it's the fit for strategy and foreign policy objectives needs to be pretty good. And it's the way you reinforce and build on the intention to have diplomacy take the lead. It's a bigger problem. The preparation of the State Department to engage in a strategy review is very, very thin. It's not a department that thinks strategically. It does not have a strategic planning capability. It doesn't contract out for work on strategy. The State Department is quite handicapped, which is a point I'm going to make in a brief I'm doing for the Quincy Institute that will be coming out sometime this month, I think, that they really... In order to make the rubber hit the road on strategy, on a really integrated strategy, we got to do something to reinforce the State Department's capability to think strategically.
Dove, your sense?
Well, I'm generally in agreement with Gordon, but it goes well beyond the State Department, quite frankly. It includes Treasury, it includes trade representative and commerce. I mean, if we're serious about all of government, then we have to be serious about all of government and all of it, not just one other agency, although it's clearly very important to have stayed in there. And that raises the question of to what extent, as this posture review is being put into place, are they going to bring people in from these agencies to help out, to provide their views, to make sure that it isn't just a purely military document, because otherwise it just doesn't do the job, quite frankly. And at what level? I mean, are these going to be people that are sent in who are juniors and just sitting against the wall and nodding off, one or the other? Or are they going to be serious people? I think if they're serious about all of government, this isn't a bad place to start. One area, by the way, where there's been a lot of continuity with the Trump people is China. I don't see any backing off. I don't see Kurt Campbell certainly backing off. And I think from the Chinese point of view, this is something they have to take very, very seriously. This is a bipartisan issue, just like, frankly, so is Saudi Arabia. And I've talked about that earlier. One other point, and that is on this stand down. To me, the question isn't the 60 days. The question is what happens after the 60 days. Racists aren't going to disappear after 60 days. And if they think all they need to do is have some kind of video training, studies have shown that video training doesn't really change anybody's opinion. There's going to have to be a personal effort ongoing that's going to be included in people's officer evaluation reports or for the enlisted, their promotions. Basically, it's going to have to be a day-to-day process. And unless it affects promotions, it ain't going to make a difference.
It's very interesting you say that, because there is a debate, including among those who lived through the Vietnam era, about, right, because the way that we dealt with racism then was to use the officer evaluation system and basically say, you're entitled to your views as long as you don't act on them. Now we're seeing that people have those views and are acting on them. And the discussion is, okay, well, how do you do this by not making the problem worse, in a sense, right? That the corrective action doesn't reinforce some of these tendencies, although I do believe this is going to be a decades-long endeavor. Byron?
Well, that just means, frankly, that just means that you need to relook at the OER system. And, you know, if there was a, and there was, we know there was a problem post-Vietnam,
right?
Then we really need to look at the lessons learned and make sure that this time around, you know, not doing something is just not enough, because you can get other people to do it on the internet.
I think it's going to be interesting to see, but I think that we were so desperate. We needed people. We needed to send them to Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Obviously, the education standards were a challenge. Physical fitness standards were a challenge, and it remains to be seen. It will be interesting to see what other potential compromises were made so that we did hit our recruiting goals at a time when the nation needed manpower to send to these wars. Byron, let me get your sense on this, because you've been tracking very carefully the rhetoric and the reality, right? McKenzie did say that there's going to be a repudiation. On many things, there is a repudiation in the shift from one administration to another. We've seen that from every administration to another. How much do you think of what Trump did, especially from a DOD acquisition standpoint, that you think this team will do differently? Because if you look at it, it was a very stable and sane pair of hands in the form of Ellen Lord, in the form of the service secretaries, Richard Spencer, Heather Wilson, and then Mark Esper and Barbara Barrett, right? I mean, these have been pretty seasoned, level-headed folks who've been in charge of these services, you know, Ryan McCarthy.
Look, I think, you know, it's a to be determined, right? There are some people, you didn't mention Roper or Hondo Gertz, who I think were really—
My apologies, absolutely. Thank you for doing so.
Foundational. You know, I think the bigger issues, and it is fascinating that the Trump administration continued things like the Defense Innovation Board and DIUX or DIU now, that could have been jettisoned because it came from the Obama administration, but thankfully they stuck with it, which I think is frankly very good. You know, I think the things that may be a little different and are in the to be determined column, how will a DOD and frankly the rest of the Biden administration look at further consolidation of the defense industry? There's going to be an early test on the Lockheed Martin Aerojet Rocketdyne merger. You know, is that another bridge too far as vertical integration is concerned in the sector? And I think the other point, you know, frankly, a lot of the innovation has been more innovation theater. It just really hasn't been a needle mover in terms of the structure of the industry, with a couple of minor exceptions. SpaceX and Palantir seem to have broken down some barriers to entry. But I think that's going to be the other really fascinating thing, because you hear a lot of this from the venture community, which is, you know, you're going to have to really make some champions, some success stories for the new entrants. And obviously that's going to create conflict and tension with the heritage contractors in the sector. But I think that's going to be another really fascinating thing to watch. And then, Vago, if I could just tag on a bit on some of the bigger questions about China and kind of where the administration is, just because it's been topical this week. I think you have to kind of go back a bit to the intent of the administration to bring in allies, specifically the EU. And it is noteworthy that, you know, the EU concluded a major agreement with China called CAI. I think it's a comprehensive access. I'm just drawing a blank on it. The agreement is called CAI. It basically tried to level a playing field for EU investment in China and vice versa. And it's fascinating because that was done on December 30th. When the EU well knew that the Biden administration, that there would be a President Biden. So I think, you know, that's kind of an interesting counterpoint to this idea that it's all going to be kumbaya and the allies are going to line up against us. I mean, if anything, you know, it's easy to talk about getting alignment with allies, but they're going to have their own interests. And that's going to be a really fascinating thing to watch play out in 2021 and beyond. It is how difficult it may be to get the administration to have not just the EU, but Japan, Korea, other countries align themselves with some of these U.S. interests that aren't always in their own interests.
We are almost out of time. Dove, 30 seconds. Michael and Arnold talked about the importance of robust boards full of experienced public service servants who can advise the senior leadership on solving big problems. Obviously, Lloyd Austin reviewing the future of these boards. Kath Hicks discussed that as well during her hearing. As somebody who founded the Defense Business Board when you were comptroller, give us and a longtime participant on a number of boards, both at a service level and DOD level. Gordon, I should say you're a past senior board member as well, including of the prestigious Defense Policy Board. Give us your sense on the way the department should move ahead on this, because there is pressure to just get rid of them. And some accuse this of, you know, self-dealing and, you know, all that is the worst in Washington as opposed to being the best.
Well, I think that what Austin has done is right. I mean, if you look at the list of boards, it's huge. It's over 40 boards. We don't need that much. And a lot of these boards really are just places where people do put their, you know, names on resumes. There's probably a dozen boards that are really needed. Beyond that, I would have my doubts. And for those boards, you need people who are really qualified. Just to give you an example, when I first created the business board, I went to a guy named Mike Baer and asked him to be vice chairman. And since then, he's been chairman three times. You need people like that and like Arnold. And what you don't need are political hacks who get these jobs as rewards for serving in an administration. I think Austin's got the right idea. I'll be very disappointed if at least half of those boards are not cut.
Quick comment on the board issue. As somebody who served on the Defense Policy Board, obviously a political hack who was padding his resume and doing so, I have to say that I think there are two boards in that whole list that I think have real value added for the department. The Defense Science Board is one of them. It's done some really important work over the decades in terms of looking at scientific issues in the department's work. And the other one, much kudos to Dove here, is the creation of the Defense Business Board, which under Michael Baer's leadership actually produced a landmark study on military retirement that made a difference. It produced a landmark study on defense overhead, which can still make a difference because it had real data in it. So some of these boards are of real value. In general, there are probably too many.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. We never have enough time to hit all the topics we want, but we really appreciate you joining us. Have a great weekend. Have a great week. Looking forward to having you back on next Friday. Thanks again.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.